And welcome back to the podcast. This is Tweester.
This is the Deuteronomist.
And we're back.
And we're back. My third time on.
That's right. And this time, we've already done Samson.
Yep.
We did the Book of Mark.
We did responses to Jesus in the Book of Mark.
Yes.
Right? Because you can't talk about a whole book in a podcast. I don't think I can.
We did a lot of it, though.
We did.
Yeah, and then
you know what? Forget that. You're an expert on Mark now. Listen to that podcast.
You understand Mark.
Literally no one can tell you something you don't already know. That's how thorough that podcast
was. Yes, exactly. And if they try to tell you, slap them. Don't even listen. Turn away from them.
Because that's what we are over here at this podcast. We're pro-closed-mindedness.
Yeah, exactly. We want
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
Whatever we say after that, you don't need any new information, and we don't want you to research any new information.
Absolutely. This is the definitive take. Whatever we say is canon.
In a way, I've always... One of the jokes that I like to make to people is that a lot of podcasts are just people listening to other people's Google searches instead of doing their own. there's some truth to that. I mean, I know that's not completely it, because different people have different experiences, or like, you didn't do a Google search for this stuff. You went to school for a long time for
this. I did not. I absolutely did not do a Google search. Fingers crossed. No, I didn't. I read a bunch of books.
So, but yeah, I don't know. I just think it's
but they
funny.
Probably did Google
There's
searches.
Definitely episodes that I've listened to of other podcasts where I'm like, this is just a Google search. And it's fine because, like, I'm still listening. Obviously, there's something I'm getting out of it, but I just thought it was funny.
Oh, shots fired over here. Mm-hmm. Shots fired.
Pew, 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 pew. Pew, lasers fired.
Lasers. Pew, pew, pew. So what are we talking about today again?
So we did Samson, we did the Book of Mark, we did Fox Facts 5, the mini-sode, to accompany Samson.
Check that out. It's
check
really
it out.
Great.
It's real short, easy to get through. And this time, as I understand it, we are going to do a little bit of Genesis.
We are. We're going to talk about Genesis chapters 1 through 3, because it's a big book. Mm-hmm. Those are basically the two creation accounts for those of you who are out there. And I think it's going to be an exciting... an exciting conversation. I also think it might be a more difficult one to have, because everyone's got a lot of, Genesis is like an unpopular or a very popular politician, or an unpopular politician, depending on who you are. Like, everyone's got an opinion, and everyone, like, loves to talk about them. Mm. Like, Genesis is like the president, not like the current president, in the sense of, if you've read one book in the Bible, you've definitely, like, you might not know who the vice president is, you might not have ever read Leviticus, but you have read Genesis, but you didn't read a lot of it, so you just read, like, the first three chapters.
Like, even if someone's like, I've never stepped foot inside of a church, they probably know the story of, at least a story of Genesis.
Absolutely.
Or they've heard of Genesis.
Did you know they did a...
And I don't mean the band with Phil Collins. He's just trying to ride the coattails of the story.
Everyone thinks that we're going to talk about a band today.
People will look it up and they'll find my music.
Did you know the Book of Genesis, they did a survey of the 100 most famous sermons? And the Book of Genesis, I think, comes up the second most.
Really?
Yeah. I think the first most is a, ironically, I think, golly... I need to fact check myself on this, but I'm pretty sure the number one most talked about, or in terms of the 100 most popular sermons of all time, the number one subject is not even use the Bible. It's just to jump around. So you can't rightly say that sermon is about like a particular passage.
Yeah.
But if it's about a passage, odds are, based on that very limited survey, it's going to be about Genesis, specifically the first three chapters.
Why do you think that's because, like, every now and then, you know, the preacher or priest or whoever looks up and they see a bunch of new faces and they're like, oh, time for another origin story? or do you think it's just because it's an easy place to default to when you're like, I don't really know what else to talk about right now that's current or that I think everyone should hear, so let's just go back to the beginning and then I'll figure it out in the next couple sermons.
I think there's a couple things going on. The first thing I think is that Genesis, if you're going for theology, mm-hmm. like today, just to clarify, I'm going to try to limit myself to the realm of biblical scholarship. I've done this in the other podcasts that you listen to, but there's a huge difference between theology and biblical scholarship. Biblical scholarship cares about what the books meant in their original context, whereas theology is like, what can we do with this book?
It's like the philosophy of.
Yeah, sort of. So theology is much more like, oh, if this says this, then this must be like, this is a revelation of the character of God and God's relationship with humanity. Whereas biblical scholars are like, this is about, this is speaking to like this document, this historical reality, mm-hmm. may or may not have been written during this time, this people. It tries to make less guesses, but that's not even quite accurate.
Because you still have to guess a little bit. Like, yeah, with any historical absolutely. Sort of study you have.
It's very historical. It's more like the, and I think I've talked about this before on this podcast, but it's like the world behind the text.
Yeah.
Whereas theology is trying to talk to the world in front of the text.
Okay.
Which is, it's very different. It's very, very different. So
today with Genesis, as I understand it, it's not just clear cut.
No. Genesis is... One of the first things we got to get out of the way right at the top of the podcast is probably say the most controversial thing, which is funny because it's really not controversial at all amongst biblical scholars or really amongst anyone who studied it.
But amongst the layman.
Amongst
the people who didn't read it, basically.
Yeah, well...
And all of whom probably have a Twitter.
I don't want to categorize people who didn't read them as not believing this, because there are tons of people who have read it,
uh-huh.
and there are ways in which you can reconcile the two texts, but you can't really harmonize them. Genesis 1, from Genesis 1:1 to about 2:4, chapter 2, verse 4, that's one creation account.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm of the opinion, and it's just my opinion, and the opinion of most biblical scholars, that from chapter 2:4 to 3... That's a completely different creation account.
So two creation accounts mm-hmm. in the first three chapters of Genesis.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, most people that I know, and from everything that I heard growing up, definitely did not hear that there were two accounts. I feel like they only ever told the one, unless maybe they just mashed them together and I didn't know.
Yeah, so they're quite different. They're quite different in form, for instance. Chapter 1, so for those of you who don't know, or you can't remember, chapter 1 is the creation of the world, like, via, over the course of 7 days, God creates piecemeal and says, this is good, this is good, this is good, this is good. He creates humanity on the 6th day, 7th day he rests. Chapter 2, verse 4 picks back up with the creation of humanity, and that's one way of reading it. You can read Genesis 1 if you want to kind of reconcile the two texts. Mm-hmm. Genesis 1 is like macro picture, the big picture of creation, and then it zooms in. For Genesis 2, but it's completely different. Like, Genesis 2 is the creation of Adam, and then Eve, and then all the bad stuff that happens after that. Like, it's there to explain why the world sucks.
Okay, so I guess in order to really tell the differences and where the split is, let's just go with the first one and see what happens.
Sure, you want to walk through the first one with me?
Yeah, let's walk through the first one.
How familiar are you with the Genesis?
In so account? Much... I mean, now, I don't know.
So the 7 days
yes,
account.
Yes, the 7 days where he created this and that on that day, yeah. And then on the 7th day he rested.
How would you go about creating Earth if you had 7 days to do it?
If I had 7 days yeah. to do it?
Well, I mean, you had 6 months, but you waited to the last 7 days.
Okay, and I had infinite cosmic power?
Yeah, sure. Yeah,
I'd
I guess
probably
you'd
rush it all on the first 2 days, and then I would rest for 5. But, you know, create earth and sea.
Uh-huh.
Right? Oh, he had to create the sun, too, didn't he? So it's not all just about Earth.
Yeah, yeah, you gotta go. Create everything.
Gotta make the rest of the planets. So I just poof, 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 poof. All of these, I'm just gonna... Just throw out randomness. I'm just going to roll random dice for the rest of them, because I'm only going to put life on one of them, except for, you know, maybe some frozen bacteria on Mars.
So you'd, like, randomly generate a few planets
yeah.
and then go, like, okay, there's
this one. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, because they're not inhabitable, so.
Yeah. Would you say it was good?
I would look on it and probably say it was good.
Yeah?
I'd probably say it was good.
That's actually one of the things I like most about... I really like Genesis 1. I like it a lot. I like it a lot for a few different reasons. I really encourage you to go read it. We'll probably read through it a little bit here. But it's really different from a lot of... It's very similar to a lot of other ancient Near Eastern creation accounts, but it's also very, very different in certain respects. And one of the things that makes it most different is God creates through word
mm-hmm.
and there's an emphasis on blessing, the goodness of what he creates through word. And the reason it's important that God creates through word is because that's inherently nonviolent. And if you read a lot of other creation accounts, they're all very, very violent.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, think about the Greek story, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you've got, what are they, the Titans?
Yeah.
Is that it?
Yeah.
And then Zeus kills his dad, and it's very bloody.
Kronos, which is a titan.
Yeah, Kronos. There you go. Like, a lot of, like...
And Kronos spends a long time... he's having sex with a demigod woman or something. Or no, she's a god. She's just not a titan. And then every time she gets pregnant, he shows up and, like, eats the baby so it doesn't become a god and then, you know, like, try to come after him. But then she hides a baby, like... behind her back or something stupid, and he's like, "Oh," and then, so he just bangs her like you do, and then he leaves, and that baby becomes Zeus, and then Zeus is like, "Fuck you, Dad!"
Absolutely, exactly, very, very, very violent, like, very soap opery. Yeah. The Enuma Elish, which is the Babylonian creation account, mm-hmm. Marduk rips Tiamat in half, and half his body becomes the sky, the other half becomes the earth.
I think something with the Viking pagan lore is mm-hmm. I didn't look it up before this. I can't remember right now.
Sure, I didn't either.
But I think I do remember some things coming about in a violent way of, like, something having to be killed in order to, like, basically create stuff.
Absolutely. Actually, could you name any peaceful... A better way to illustrate it was, could you be able to name any peaceful creation accounts?
Yeah. Cherokee creation myths.
Really?
Its wings and it created some lakes... And, you know, the bird flapped its wings a little harder. And it created some mountains. So it's very much of, like, hey, nature's fun and friendly. And that's probably why they have their idea of nature being, even whenever they have to, like, kill and eat animals, they're like, thank you for giving me this food kind of thing, you know?
That's wonderful. You know, another people on the podcast, some people are going to disagree with me because it depends on what era of Egyptian history you're talking about. But some of the late... Egyptian creation myths, because they've got early creation myths and then they've got later, because Egyptian religion became more monotheistic over time, that's not true. It was not monotheistic, and then suddenly with one pharaoh, it was very monotheistic. He was like, "We're changing this."
Yeah.
But in that era, yeah, they're all creation, very similar to Genesis through word and peace. So that's the only one I can think of.
Okay.
Which the Israelites may or may not have immigrated from Egypt, so maybe they're borrowing some
stuff there.
There's
probably other ones that we just haven't heard of or not familiar with that are also peaceful, but I don't think it's unsafe to say that there are a bunch of very violent creation myths.
Absolutely. And, you know, the Bible gets a bad rap in a lot of circles, and deservedly so. There's some awful texts in there, but I really just want to highlight that. I think this is one of the good ones. This is one of those texts that, as a pacifist myself, like, I really like the idea of this inherent goodness in creation.
Yeah, I'm just going to speak it, and then it's made. And, you know, I would take a long time making animals, because that'd be the fun part.
Yeah?
Yeah, just, like, mixing stuff together. Except I make the dinosaurs first. I'm like, oh, no, I shouldn't have done that. I have to, like, you know, put the kibosh on that and just throw a rock at the planet. And then they're like, all right, now time to put some fun animals on there. Those are all mean and, like, eating each other.
Absolutely. So you'd say, your revision, instead of 2 days, you'd spend, like, 2 days making the base and then, like, 3 days doing the animals.
Yeah, probably. I'd spend a lot more time, like, with the animals and stuff, putting it on and putting it together. I mean, the one day I would waste with the dinosaurs, and then I'd be like, none of those are cuddly. And then the other 2 days I'd make stuff that you can actually, like, pet or hang out with, or see, they're cool to see them running along. Like,
would you make humans?
Eesh.
I know, that's a big responsibility.
That's a tough one.
It's like children. Well, yeah. Let's dive into the first verse, because I think the first verse illustrates some of the... I think it illustrates some of how theology can build up, or how people can use Genesis to extract theological claims out of something that might not have ever been meant for that.
Okay.
And also, that since we live in a scientific world, that's also just another issue. I really should add theology, like, there's in the room that is Genesis, in all of our minds, there's a lot of, like, theological crap and, like, scientific crap. And I'll say at the start that I'm not convinced that these are historical accounts. I'm convinced that they're fictional accounts that may have theological value. They may tell us something about the world, namely that it started good, but things are wrong, and that God wants to have a relationship with us. I think those theological broad themes are very true. I do not think the accounts are entirely historically accurate. And there's a lot of good reasons for that. But that's the perspective I'm coming at it with. If that's not your perspective, I respect that. But let's get into just this first verse.
Let's do it.
So already there's controversy. First word. Yeah,
the very
yeah.
beginning?
Yeah, absolutely. So you've probably heard it translated in the beginning. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth.
Yeah, right. I've heard that a lot.
Right. So that could be an interpretation of it.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Hebrew, the vowels, originally when these were written, Hebrew is all consonants and the vowels are written under the consonants.
Okay.
And originally when this was written, there were no vowels. They were added later. So depending upon how you include vowels, it either reads as in the beginning God created, or it reads when God created. And the reason this is significant is because of the doctrine of creation ex nihilo, the idea that God created out of nothing. Because the only biblical basis for that doctrine is this one line, the idea that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, which assumes that nothing was there. But if we read it as when God created, then you suddenly getting this idea that, you know, there was stuff happening.
Could be there were rocks floating around and he just picked one and he's like, let me put something here.
Yeah, that's absolutely a valid, that's like the idea that stuff was already happening before God created. Absolutely. And there's no right or wrong answer here. Like,
because
people,
there's no way to prove either way.
Yeah, you could read it either way. It depends on whether it's a temporal or a circumstantial clause. And there's just, it's how do you wanna write the vowels underneath it?
Yeah, right off the bat, controversy, you're right.
Yeah, first thing.
First line. Oh God, we're never gonna get there.
All right, well, that's one thing, and it's very important to theological doctrine. Again, I don't think these texts are about, we shouldn't try to extract like broad theological, very, very precise theological claims from like the Bible, that it says this, so that must mean there was absolutely nothing before. I think we're already kind of taking a misstep when we're looking for those sorts, that sort of information.
Yeah, the I'm definitely right in a very specific way, and anyone else who reads it in a different way than me is definitely wrong.
Absolutely, this text that was written thousands of years ago
gives us very accurate.
Yeah. But, you know, some people,
I have the right genes and the best brain, and I know exactly what it means.
Oh, really? Me too.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, crud! How did that happen? Wait, you don't agree with me, though, do you?
Yeah, but I have the right genes and was born at the right time.
Oh, crap. I'm gonna have to kill you, otherwise people might think you're right.
And we just summarized all of human
history. The Crusades?
Yeah, I mean, the Crusades, I think, and, literally, like all of human history.
You have some claim, and you might be right to other people, but I gotta kill you.
Yeah, sorry, bro. You're gonna die. So, going back to the creation, so there's Genesis 1 is about the creation of the earth over the course of 7 days. Instead of reading through it, I'll broadly summarize, but I do want to like go back to one of them, because one of the days always really confused me when I was young, mm-hmm. and now that I've studied it, it makes more sense.
Okay.
But so if I were to structure this in your minds, give you a place to hang your hat, you could think of the first days as the creation of static reality,
mm-hmm.
the next 3 days is the creation of like dynamic reality, and then rest on the seventh day.
Static reality and dynamic reality. Explain.
And again, this isn't like me being like, I'm just imposing a structure on it. I don't think that the author necessarily, he might have tightly structured it because the things line up really, really well. But this is just a helpful memory device.
Okay.
So hopefully you can remember it. So on day one, again, we're dealing with static reality.
Mm-hmm.
We've got light and dark.
Okay.
Creation of light and dark, it's good.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Day two is the one I am going to read here after I go over this overview, because day two is weird, and unless you understand Hebrew cosmology, you don't understand what in the world's going on. You've got this firmament, which, first of all, if you read like the King James Version, they use the word firmament. What the hell's a firmament?
I don't know.
Yeah, I didn't either.
Alcoholic in me is like, fermentation? Is that what you said?
Yeah, God created fermentation on the second day. he got light and dark, and he wanted things to get, he wanted to get blackout, so he was like, let's,
like, oh, this light is good. I need a drink. That's already so different, yeah.
Yeah, he got into day two of his project, and he already wanted to start drinking.
He was testing the differences between night drinking and day drinking.
Mm, yeah, exactly. He wanted to know. But firmament, dome, and some people are like, oh, he's creating the sky and the land. No, if you actually read the text, it says he creates a firmament in order to separate. Again, we're talking about static reality. The waters above and the waters below. That's weird. We'll get back to it in a second. Mm-hmm. All right. So on the third day, then he creates, he goes down to the, it focuses on the waters below, and he separates the seas from the land.
Okay.
Sea, land. So we have three static realities. The dome is the sky. The firmament's okay. The sky. He creates the sky. The sky is what separates the waters above, the waters below.
So space and the atmosphere?
Yeah. Again, they're sort of.
Like, that's just how...
They don't know what the word atmosphere... Like, Hebrews have no...
Me as a modern man, that's my I might think of it.
This is... And this is... I'm glad you brought that up, because, again, we bring a lot of scientific baggage... Mm-hmm. Whenever we go to read Hebrews, and Hebrews is not at all trying to give a scientifically accurate account of reality.
I mean, they could just see the blue sky and be like, ah, the sky waters.
Actually, we can go ahead and talk about this now. I'll read the passage so that we can all be on the same page, because it is very weird, and we'll just talk about why this is so weird now. But this starts in verse 6. So God said, let there be a dome in the middle of the waters to separate the waters from each other. God made the dome and separated the waters under the dome from the waters above the dome. And it happened in that way. God named the dome sky. By the way, if you're wondering, if you're like a really good listener and you're reading along, I am reading from the CEB translation. I've also got a Hebrew, one of the best Hebrew study Bibles in front of me that I might also read from. But and I'll make it clear if I switch between the two. But that's where this translation's coming from. So what you got to understand is if anytime you see waters in the Old Testament and even in the New Testament, mm-hmm. they always think of the waters as like the formless matter from which creation was made. In fact, in the early verses in Genesis, it talks about before God creates, everything is formless and void.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't really know what the text is imagining. In my opinion, formless and void is probably like a phrase like helter skelter.
Mm-hmm.
It just
is.
Yeah, it kind of means chaos.
They're like, you imagine whatever you're going to imagine.
Yeah, yeah. It means because things are kind of like unorganized, mm-hmm. but it's not very specific. So if you're imagining anything specific, probably not. But they associated water with chaos.
Oh, okay.
So actually, the best way to understand Hebrew cosmology is imagine that if there's anything that's formless and void, there's just water, right? And the world exists within a bubble, boom, within that water. And if you stop to think about it, it actually makes a lot of sense for an ancient thinker, right? Because if you walk in any direction, what do you eventually hit?
Water.
Yeah, you eventually hit water, and then, like, what comes out of the sky?
Water.
Water. So if you don't like understand the water cycle or the evaporation, like there's water above the sky. In fact,
and the sky is blue.
Yeah, the sky's I don't know if they had it was the same color as the water. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they had a concept of a color blue. That's actually like really late. That doesn't emerge. The color blue doesn't appear in ancient. This is actually a side note. This is another new, but it doesn't appear in any like ancient text until like painters were able to they got access to the color blue through the creation of seashells. I think during the Renaissance.
I would think that like you could still make a connection from seeing water in the sky.
That's, yeah, exactly. They're like, still the
they
same.
Don't look
the whatever
same
color
shade,
that is,
but you're like that's there's similarities there.
Actually, in the flood account, there's a passage where that's really really confusing. Unless you understand this cosmology, and most of your Bibles out there translate it incorrectly because it's so weird. When God decides to flood the earth, which is a horrible thing to do, it says the windows in the sky open up.
Huh.
And that only makes sense if you think there's water up there.
If there's water up there, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So that's, so when people say on the second day God separated the sky and the land, well, that's not accurate. The way the text is imagining it is the God is separating the waters above from the waters below. He uses a dome. That dome is called the sky. And that's okay. What the firmament is. It's this dome. So that's really weird. So let me go back and
I get a better picture now from that explanation.
Yeah, because it's so weird if you read it. You're like, what in the world? Water's above, water's below. But to an ancient mind, again, there's walk in any direction, you're going to get water.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes a lot of sense. But if we bring this scientific understanding, like our modern worldview to the text, you're never going to understand what the text is trying to tell you. You're just not.
Mm-hmm.
Just like if you bring theological assumptions to the text, it's only going to ever hurt you. And that's what makes Genesis
so rough. You have
so
to allow
rough.
Your perspective to be malleable. You need to try to remember, you know, who this came around. Like, who were the minds at the time when this came about?
Yeah, I think
this was written down.
I think just like when you meet a new person, you've got to make space in your mind to let that person be different.
Yeah.
You've got to make space in your mind to let these texts be different and let them say things that aren't what you expected them to say.
Yeah.
Which is, I think it's like a hospitality issue. It's like an understanding issue. It's being charitable. Anyway, so back to the structure. Day one, we got separation of light and dark. It's good. Day two, we got separation of waters above, waters below.
Mm-hmm.
Day three, we've got a distinction. We're just looking at the waters below now.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got a distinction between the sea. That's not the word they use, but it's a good word.
Okay.
Sea and land, right? And now we've got static reality.
Okay.
Static reality. Now let's go back to dynamic reality. Dynamic reality, we return to the light and dark,
mm-hmm.
and we've got to populate the light and dark with two luminaries. In this case, the text, the sun and the moon.
Sun and the moon.
But the text doesn't say sun and moon. It says a big light and small light.
Okay.
So we've got on the fourth day, creation of the sun and the moon. On the fifth day, again, let's return to that distinction between waters above, waters below. He creates birds and fish. So on the fifth day, we create birds and fish to populate the waters above, the sky, roughly, and the waters below, the fish. And then on the sixth day, we return to the difference between the sea and the land, and specifically now the land, and we fill the land with all the creatures that roam the land, including humans. And then on the seventh day, there's rest.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully that structure and the way those two pairings kind of line up with one another. You can't see me, but I'm intertwining my fingers and I hope is not a
I was about to say, who's that for? Just me?
It is. It's just for you, Tweester, and the viewers.
They can do it too.
Yeah, just intertwine your fingers.
Or anything.
Just make an E with one hand and a backward E with the other, line them up, and then you've got your two pairings. Three static realities, three dynamic realities that each kind of relate to one another, and that'll help you remember it. Quiz your friends, try not to come off like a jerk.
As pompous? No, you know so much more than they can know. Be pompous.
You know,
they know nothing, the fools.
Absolutely. Like I said, if there's one thing this podcast encourages, it's closed-mindedness. And closed-mindedness begins. It begins and ends with arrogance. So what would we be if we didn't recommend it?
Lord your information over them.
We also get in here. So, you know, I love Genesis 1, but we also get some controversy.
Again? We just had some.
We did. I mean, tons of controversy, absolutely. But I guess controversy not actually, yeah, in the sense of what's being argued. But we get some passages that are theologically very heavy, just like that first verse.
Mm-hmm.
And we also get some passages that are practically, in the history of Christianity and the history of the world, have been a little destructive.
Okay, so what comes next? Let's hit it. Let's see
what
we got.
So let's talk about that sixth day, because in the seventh day, God's done with his God's done with her project. I don't mean to use the masculine pronoun. God is done with God's project. They're really big about that in all the theological schools I've trained in.
Uh-huh.
You shouldn't use, and I agree with them, you shouldn't. God's not a man. God's probably not a woman.
I mean, I know that wouldn't make sense to try to explain a god in a male or female, like, biological way. But I thought in the Bible, a lot of times his prophets always called him a him.
Yeah, they use it in the same way that we've historically used, like, man. Like, in order to talk about all of humanity, they used
mankind
to talk about God. Just because you got to go with a pronoun.
Mm.
And, you know, I'm not going to pretend like the authors weren't a little sexist. I mean, you gotta put everything in a little.
Yeah.
A lot sexist.
That's
very
generous.
Yeah, I know. You got to put everything in context. And but I personally don't believe that God has a gender. Or...
wouldn't make sense to.
That doesn't make sense to my mind. If you disagree with me,
then give a 5-star
review. Yeah, give a 5 comment below saying...
And tell us
God
why.
Has a gender. Does God have sex organs? Tell me. Explain how you know. I won't read it. but let's dive into some controversy here. So 6th day, God is creating man. Blah blah blah. Da 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 da. And I'm reading from the CEB here. No wonder I can't find it. That is the 5th day. All right, so God said, let the earth produce every kind of living thing, livestock, crawling things, and wildlife. And that's what happened. God made every kind of wildlife, every kind of livestock, and every kind of creature that crawls in the ground. God saw how good it was. Then God said, and this is where he turns from creating all the creatures to humanity. Then God said, let us make humanity in our image to resemble us so that they may take charge of the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, the livestock, all of the earth, and all the crawling things on the earth. God created humanity in God's own image. In the divine image, God created them. Male and female, God created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fertile and multiply, fill the earth and master it. Take charge of the fish of the sea, the birds in the sky, and everything crawling on the ground. And then he does the same thing he gives. It's very repetitive. God gives us power or authority over all the other things. Okay. So there's so much to talk about there.
So he's like, you're my park rangers.
Yes, I like that. I like that. I want you to hold on to it.
Okay.
We're going to come back to that, this idea that we are God's park rangers. So the first thing to talk about here is the us. So let's go back to verse 26. This is a bit of theology. Theologians, especially Christians theologians, getting their grubby paws on a Hebrew text.
Mm-hmm.
I think over-interpreting it. Verse 26, then God said, let us make humanity in our image to resemble us so that they may take charge of the blah, blah, blah. Why is the plural being used of God there?
Is that where, like, the old angels come in?
You know, maybe, possibly. So Christians tend to read that and go, Trinity. Trinity. Oh,
the Father, the Son, and
yeah,
the Holy Ghost.
This is proof. And God does breathe in the creation is very beautiful in Genesis 1. Like, God breathes out over the formless void, and they look at that breath and go, spirit, breath. In the Greek, it's the same word. They go, oh, that's the Holy Spirit. See, there's Trinity from the beginning. I think in fairness to Hebrew text, that's not what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of the Old Testament, there's some debate over whether Hebrew religion was originally monotheistic. The correct word, oh gosh, I'm not going to say the correct word because I don't remember how to pronounce it. It starts with an H. And I would just look dumb. But the idea is that God is the head of, like, a divine council. There are other gods, but our God, Yahweh or Elohim, he's on top.
Mm-hmm.
He or she or it. I guess it's appropriate to use the masculine pronoun because that's how the ancient Hebrews described it in this case. But that God is the highest God. So whenever they're saying us, they're imagining a divine council.
Okay.
Another way to explain it is it could be an honorific. This is another theory. So, like, during royal times, kings and queens would refer to themselves in the plural.
As to say, like, I speak for all of you?
Yeah. Like, it's really... it's a thing you do for really high up people. So it could just be like God's so important that it's plural. But I think what's going on is the original authors are imagining like a divine council.
Okay, because like you said, there's some talk about whether they started out monotheistic or not.
Absolutely. And there's some psalms where absolutely they're imagining a divine council. And spoilers, a lot of those psalms are older than Genesis. Even though Genesis comes first, it's not the oldest text at all. The oldest text is probably Job, by quite a lot. Quite a lot. a whole lot. Anyway.
Older than Deuteronomy.
Oh, yep. Yep, way older than That's Deuteronomy. That's old. Yeah, I know, right? So much older. Anyway, so I just wanted to, for those of you who are listening closely and like, why does God refer to himself in the plural? Those are three possible interpretations. It could be a divine honorific. It could be proof of the Trinity. If you're a Christian, who these texts just have to align with your theology, which... it's fine, a little rude to, Jewish people, but fine. And the other is that the text is actually imagining a divine council. Anyway, so then there's this idea of human creation in God's own image, in the image of God. God created them, male and female, God created them. So being created in the image of God, how familiar are you with that idea? The Imago Dei, as theologians love to call it.
The Imago Dei?
Yeah, it's just Latin for image of God. Oh. But if you want to sound really pretentious, if you're writing a paper about the image of God...
The Imago Dei.
The Imago Dei.
It's going to be like my next Mortal Kombat character I create.
Dude, you got beat by the image of God.
Pretty hard, too. He had a sword and everything. Yeah, I mean, that's the way I've always heard it, is that we are created in his image. And I was like, well, what does that mean? And they were like, well, I mean, this is like, we don't look like him, but this is about what he would look like if he were going to be a human.
Really? That's the interpretation that
you heard? That's the one I heard, yeah.
That's like the worst of all the interpretations.
I always thought it was weird because I was like...
No, theologian I've ever read has ever aired the idea that... Then later, I heard that
they like... people, humans, had such a hard time looking upon angels because we can't comprehend what they really look like. And I was like, well, wait, weren't they also made in the image of God? Don't they just kind of look like us?
What?
And they're like, well, no, but we don't have divine light. And I'm like, none of this makes any... You're just making things up as I ask questions.
Oh my gosh.
Swear, I've talked to a bunch of, like, fantasy world builders... just keep adding things every time I find a loophole.
Oh my gosh, now I just want to talk to... I really wish I had more listeners in here, because that interpretation is so far out of left field from what I would even consider.
Well, tell me what's going on there.
So, man, there's so much to talk about here. Historically, this idea of being created in the image of God has meant different things at different times. And honestly, it's become a way for people to read their particular interpretation of humanity onto the text.
Mm-hmm.
So in the early days of the church, so if you go all the way back to Augustine, who's writing in like the 2nd and 3rd century AD, he thinks, because the Greeks believe in the separation of the mind and body, that we are created in the image of God because we are rational. That's what unites us with God. It's our rationality. It makes us like God. But in order to get that reading is absolutely not in the text. You'd have to import a lot of Greek philosophy. Mm-hmm. It makes a lot of sense. And I think for thinkers like myself, like people who like to think deeply about things, that resonates with them, because it's kind of like it's like back padding, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I'm smart. Yeah, God's smart. I'm like God insofar as I'm smart.
Yeah, our ability to think and feel, like the combination of it.
Well, they would say, the ancient church would say, not feel, they'd say think.
Only think?
Yeah, feeling belongs to the body, and mind and body are different.
Okay, so it's just because of we have the most complex ability to think of any other animal.
Yeah, it's our rationality, it's our ability to reason through things that make us like God.
Okay.
All right, and that relates to the, well, I could go off on a tangent. Guys, there's so much here that, like, we could just talk about this one verse for like 2 hours, and I could talk about all the unfolding implications for the way this verse is. Anyway, so rationality, early church, we're talking about the history of this interpretation, that was dominant for a very long time. Probably the next thinker to jump to, just to give you an idea how dominant that interpretation was, is probably Barth in the 20th century,
mm-hmm.
when there's this and I don't like using this word, but I don't know what other word to use, a brand of liberal theologians, liberal scholarship from the liberal schools in Germany at the turn of the 20th century. The big idea was relationality. Relationality exploded the scene, and everyone, if you read theology from that period, so the 1900s,
okay,
you know, first of all, Germans are the best theologians in the world at that time. That's where they are. Or the Protestant theologians, best Protestant theologians, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
Catholic, you might look elsewhere, maybe. Everyone's doing relational theology. That's what they're calling it. And they're calling it, or they're calling it social theology over here in America. That's emerging. So that's the new hot topic. So that's the new thing that gets read onto it. They look at that. Remember how we talked about us just a second ago?
Yeah.
They say, oh, well, if you look in the text, the text is trying to clue us into the idea that God is inherently relational by the mentioning of us. So by being created in God's image, what that is saying is, like God, we are relational in our very being. So it's a little more attached to the text. It incorporates this kind of pop emphasis on, or not pop, this kind of new idea of a social understanding of theology onto the scene. But it's definitely more interesting. There's this relational idea. It's new. It's on the scene. It's very cool. I like it. I don't think that's what the text means, but I like it. The better idea is let's look at the verses that immediately follow it. So verse 27 is where, you know, God created humanity in God's own image. In the divine image, God created them. Male and female, God created them. Great. Verse 28, God blessed them and said to them, be fertile and multiply. Fill the earth and master it. Now, this is where we get into some controversy. That word, fill the earth and master it. First of all, let me pause and say, God tells you to go have sex.
He does.
I think that's really cool.
Fill this earth up.
Fill it up, baby. So let's give the Bible its due. It probably means have children, but at the same time, I think that's kind of cool. So back to the less cool of the part of the verse, the fill the earth and master it.
Mm-hmm.
If you read that in the King James, it's going to say dominate.
I'm getting some bondage vibes again.
Master
and slave.
You absolutely, and you know what? If you read some Renaissance thinkers, not necessarily theologians, like Francis Bacon, they imagine nature as a woman that needs to be dominated by the intellect, because that's when the rationalization, the idea that our reason is what makes us like God, and we're supposed to dominate nature with our mind, and it became a way for us to be environmentally unfriendly, justify environmentally
unfriendly. To be shitty, Oh, no, but it's okay, because we're supposed to dominate.
Does
that mean, like, kill all of this animal? Like, come on.
It's not a nice thing, and I prefer the CEB translation, master it, but I think that verse tells us a lot more of what it means to be created in the image of God. Let me go on real quick. But that this is important, because the way I'm going to connect this idea of mastering to the Imago Dei, or the image of God, will tell us what both mean. So take charge of the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, and everything crawling on the ground. Then God said, I now give to you all the plants on the earth that yield seeds, and all the trees whose fruits produce its seeds within. These will be your food, to all the wildlife, to all the birds of the sky, and to everything crawling on the ground, to everything that breathes. I give all the green grasses for food, and that's what happened. God saw everything he had made. It was supremely good. So God, immediately after creating us in the image of God, he gives us everything he's created.
Okay.
One way of understanding this is what is called this royal representative ideology. And the idea is, in the same way that a king will give his representatives authority when he's not around, God is giving us authority to act as his representatives here on earth, over the earth, in his stead. And that's what it means to be created in the image of God. Does this make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, he's like your upper management.
Yeah, well, not just...
back to the park ranger thing. Yes, too.
Yeah. So this is where the park ranger thing comes in. We are God's park rangers. We're meant. Things are ours, but we should be treating them in the way in which God would treat and handle his or her creation.
Maybe someone would be like the people who are mastering the animals in nature correctly are like, say, the people that learn how to treat injured animals, and the people that learn how to study animal behavior, the people that learn how to, you know, help plants thrive. Like, those are the masteries that he meant, maybe, is one way to look at it.
Well, I think this is that maybe, I don't know what the original author meant.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what he meant, but I think if we want to act like God, we've got to, well, I think if we want to act like God, we've got to understand the character of God, and this is where your particular religion of flavor comes. Like, whatever your flavor is, I would align myself with Christianity, so I would say the content and character of God is, compassion, justice, mercy, mm-hmm. and that these are the sorts of attributes and values that we bring to bear with the way in which we engage with creation. But right. This is, again, I know I'm doing theology, I'm not doing biblical scholarship.
Yeah.
But the reason that this text is, like, really, really important and really, really cool is if, as I think, so spoilers, Genesis, I think, was written, I've already talked about how it's not the oldest book, for reasons that it would just take way too long to get into, I think it was written during the Babylonian exile. So to set that up, Jerusalem falls in, like, 590 or 597, and Babylon takes over Jerusalem. And they send the Jewish people, there's a diaspora, which just means a scattering. Mm-hmm. And they take the, basically the elites, and they spread them around throughout the empire. This was one way of, like, you take the elite caste, and you don't leave them in Jerusalem. You spread them out, so you don't have to deal with them anymore. Because that's where the problems are going to come from. This was a common ancient practice when one people conquered another.
Okay.
In order to keep revolts from happening.
Gotcha.
So probably what has happened is you've got this Jewish person living in, you know, Babylon, and he's reading all these Babylonian creation myths, like the Enuma Elish, which is very violent, and how it ends, Marduk kills Tiamat, Marduk then founds Babylon, and he becomes the first king of Babylon, and every king of Babylon after that is said to have the image of God.
Hmm.
So only kings represent God on earth. So you're this Hebrew person who is hearing this story, and I don't know if you've written, if this is when it was written, or if I don't want to speculate too much on the mechanist, like how this story actually emerged. But
this could be it.
Yeah, I think sometime during this era, maybe they start to pull on different traditions, or something emerges where this idea of, like, no, kings aren't in the image of God. Everyone's created in the image of God. We're all God's representatives. And as God's representatives, I think that this is like a pitch for human dignity. Mm-hmm. Like, we all have, like, this dignity as creatures created in the image of God that cannot be, like, eliminated or transverse. Or, like, you can't just do away with it.
It doesn't take people very long to get tired of the divine right bullshit of kings.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is like one of those early verses that they don't like that. It's like the democratization of, like, divinity. So there's a little bit of divinity in each one of us as God's representatives. And I actually think that's rather beautiful. But you only get that if you understand sort of the cultural context in which it was written, and you connect those verses where God gives us authority over the earth to the Imago Dei. I think that's what it means. We aren't like God in the sense that we look like God, or we think like God, or that we even relate to others like God, although we might very well do that. But insofar as we all have this dignity in the sight of others as representatives of God on earth.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. We're the favored of all the animals.
Sort of. Yeah, we definitely are. I mean, we're definitely, there's a clear distinction between us and the other animals.
Trusting you all with something that I don't trust other animals with. Like,
Yeah, exactly. We're the only ones who can, like, take care of things.
Yeah.
Like, God's like, hey, I'm not peace, and while I'm gone, like, you gotta take care of stuff.
You're the park rangers.
You know, you are, you're acting for me. I think that's actually a message I think anyone can get behind,
mm-hmm.
whether you believe in God or not, especially if you don't believe in God. Who else is going to represent divinity, whatever is most noble in humanity, to
than
humanity?
Us.
Yeah, that's like, that's how we settle that controversy. And I think when we read the master verse, like master the world, in that context, like, you're not going to use it to abuse, like, creation.
Yeah. But some people have picked that out and been like, ah, see, we can do whatever we want, see? slash and burn.
And, you know, to be honest, there's also other interpretations of the Imago Dei. Those are the three big ones, historically. I won't get into the other ones because we're starting to get a little too niche. But if you're interested in this sort of stuff, I cannot recommend more highly The Liberating Image by Richard Middleton, African-American theologian, although that doesn't take center stage in his theology, which it does in some theologies.
Mm-hmm.
Easily one of the most brilliant, in terms of like laying things out very plainly. I don't know if his stuff, if there are other theologians, listen to this, you need to read his book. If you're a lay person, you're going to be confused, but it's really good.
So that was the first story, creation story?
That was the first creation story. We're created, and it ends with kind of humans being created in the image of God, being given authority to act in God's stead,
mm-hmm.
then God rests.
Okay.
Boom.
Okay. He's like, that was a lot, I'm tired.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And it was, you know, it is a lot, there's a lot more abstract there than what people usually like to teach.
I think. Yeah.
People usually like to get straight to like some human stuff. They skip over so much.
Absolutely. And it, just broad picture, like that story is very structured, very well organized, you know, 7 days. I talked about the pattern. For those of you who are interested in Pentateuch authorship, one of the dominant theories is that there's 4 source traditions, not 4 authors, not even really 4 editors, but 4 traditions that are being pulled from: a priestly source, an Elohimist source, which that's the Hebrew word for God,
mm-hmm.
a Yahwehist source, which that's the Hebrew word for specifically God that some Jewish practitioners even today don't think should be pronounced or written. In your Bibles, anytime you see Lord, all the letters are capitalized, that's
mm-hmm.
Yahweh.
Oh, and they don't think it should be written down?
Well, if it's a Christian Bible, they do.
Right.
We don't care as Christians if
but in
it's Yahweh.
Hebrew Bible,
in a Hebrew Bible, I'm not entirely certain what they are. I do know that amongst very conservative, what do you call a conservative,
like,
Jewish
Orthodox?
An Orthodox Jew.
Mm-hmm.
They write, they won't even write the word God, they write G/D. Because they think it's too holy. Because you can always, if I write something down, I can destroy it. And the name of God itself is already just so holy. And I don't even know what they would do with the word Yahweh. That's like probably too much.
Yeah.
Regardless, so you've got, again, these 4 source traditions: a priestly, an Elohimist, a Yahwehist, and you've got a Deuteronomist, which is
probably the best one.
Probably. He's probably the best one. His stuff is the clearest.
Uh-huh.
Or his or her or it. Again, these aren't people. These are like source traditions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's widely believed that the chapter 1 is the priestly source. Very concerned with getting all the details right, with preserving history, with holiness. You get a lot of blessing language. Whenever God says it is good, that's just the Hebrew word for blessing. There's like a blessing being given.
Oh, okay.
So that it's very hard to translate it as blessing, but that's the same word as blessing. So there's this focus on like goodness, blessing, structure, ordered. It's semi-poetic. And then Genesis chapter 2, it reads like a soap opera. It's like a, you know, God.
That's when everything goes downhill.
Yeah, there's Adam, and then God creates Eve from a rib, and it's...
Well, wait, let's not get ahead of ourselves. Let's take a little break.
Sure, let's do it.
And then let's do the second creation story in this part 2.
Okay. Yeah, let's try it.
So we're going to take a quick break, and then part 2.
Part 2.